is Maytag Month, and Menards is passing the savings on to you. You need reliable and energy-efficient appliances to conquer the day. Menards is your one-stop shop with appliances in stock and ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Save big money on Maytag appliances at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Here on Stolen Lives, we discuss brutal and heartbreaking crimes against children. Themes may include child murder, torture, and sexual, domestic, and child abuse. I do try my best to remain respectful for the babies in these stories and leave out unnecessary details that, honestly, none of us need to know to understand the frustration of why and how this ever happened. However, if you find any of these themes triggering, this podcast may not be for you. Listener discretion is advised. January 2009. Melbourne, Victoria. Arthur Freeman was driving his three children across the West Gate Bridge. It would be his four-year-old daughter Darcy's first day of school. Unfortunately, she would never make it, for reasons no one would ever be able to explain. Freeman calmly exited his vehicle with Darcy in his arms, and he tossed her off the bridge. Freeman went back to his car with his other two children inside, and he drove away. It wouldn't be long before Freeman would be apprehended, arrested and charged with the little girl's murder. But what would cause a loving, doting father to murder his own daughter? This is Darcy's story.
He's got out of the car, taken this young girl and dropped her over the side of the bridge.
58 metres down, 17 stories, a four-year-old. Her name was Darcy. Water police responded to frantic calls to Triple O. They pulled her from the water. Paramedics worked on her for 50 minutes, still trying to resuscitate her as she was rushed to hospital.
Arthur Philip Freeman was born in 1977 in Melbourne, Victoria, to parents Norma and Peter Freeman. Freeman would later be described as always being a little different. During his early school years, Freeman struggled to form friendships and he grew up to be a loner. This odd and disconnected behaviour during this period resulted in a spell at an alternative school for children with behavioural problems. Even here, he didn't fit in, and his old-fashioned name and eccentric behaviour made him a target for bullying. Arthur was mocked, taunted, told he smelled, and beaten regularly. But he would never fight back or even argue. He just took the bullying and didn't complain. By the time Arthur reached high school, he was back in mainstream schooling. Freeman remained excluded from his peers and didn't have the social skills to engage with children his own age. However, Freeman did excel academically. He went to university and gained an honours degree in computer science. He even made a few friends, with whom he rebuilt cars with to race on the weekends and to drink with. However, Freeman preferred his own company, and would be known to sit up all night playing games on his PlayStation, and not sleeping for more than a few hours a night. It wouldn't be just his personality that made Freeman different. His appearance made him a target for bullying too. By the time he reached his early 20s, he had already lost the hair on the crown of his head. But instead of keeping it short, he insisted on growing the sides and back long and kept it unkempt. Everything would change, though, when he met Peter Barnes. Arthur Freeman and Peter Barnes worked together, with friends encouraging the pair to date. She gave him the confidence to cut his hair and start socialising. All the while, he became a high achiever in his career, Freeman going on vacations, joining friends for long lunches, and soon a promotion came along, followed by another and another. Freeman and Peter married December 31st, 1999, in Perth, Western Australia. Soon after their wedding, the couple moved to Maidenville, a nicer part of London, for more than 6 years. Freeman worked in IT since graduating from university and received an enticing offer that couldn't be refused financially. And at first, the relationship seemed to be a perfect match. Freeman was quietly spoken and a textbook introvert, while Peter was an extrovert, and she pushed Freeman to do things he would have otherwise not taken the chance to do. After the contract work expired, the couple moved back to Australia, to Hawthorne, a suburb of Melbourne. This sparked a change in Freeman. He started to resent Peter and blamed her for the move back to Australia. He became rigid, inflexible, and struggled with the change. Yet for those who knew him, they thought Freeman to be an ordinary guy. He had many hobbies. He still rebuilt cars and still drank beers with his friends. Freeman enjoyed skiing and loved being a dad to his three children, 6-year-old Benjamin, 4-year-old Darcy Iris, and 2-year-old Jack. He had his wife, his soulmate Peter. Being a father and a family man meant everything to him. After their return to Australia, Freeman struggled to find work and became the children's full-time carer. So his entire world was his children. Arthur Freeman was the kind of dad that played beach soccer with the boys and took Darcy to her ballet lessons. She was his little princess, and she would often seek out her daddy for hugs and comfort. By March 2007, the marriage had become increasingly volatile. Peter would see two different doctors in a short period of time and disclosed problems with her, quote, angry, irrational husband who shoves and pushes her and is often angry at the kids, unquote. Peter told the doctors that she was concerned about Freeman's violent behaviour and that it was going to extend to the children. Now, as we know from other stories we tell here on Stolen Lives, doctors are mandatory reporters when it comes to the safeguarding of children. In Australia, there is mandatory reporting to the Department of Community Services, or DOCS, as they're more commonly known as at the time this story takes place. There has been an uphaul since then, since I left the department. Whether that has improved anything, that's up for debate. Regardless, whether what Peter was telling the doctors, whether that met reporting requirements was subjective. And in both of these cases, the doctors failed to report Peter's concerns. Both doctors wrote on their reports that Peter was working with lawyers and the police. And in their opinions, that was the best method for her to report her concerns. And the reason for this involvement with lawyers and police was following an ugly incident between the couple. We are just going to take a quick break now for a word from one of our sponsors. One evening in April of 2007, Freeman and Peter would come to a decision to separate. However, this discussion was not amicable. As Peter stood to leave, Freeman grabbed toddler Jack and held him towards the open fireplace. In the panic of thinking that Freeman was going to throw him into the flames, Peter bit him. Peter's mother was witness to all of this, and she slammed a metal baby stroller into Freeman's back. The police were called, and a shared custody arrangement was put in place. This arrangement would stay the same until the day before Darcy's death. Freeman and Peter divorced in June 2008, but he wasn't fully accepting the marriage was over. He continued wearing his wedding ring right up until his arrest. A few months later, Freeman went to England for 3 months to sort out a UK residency issue, staying with friends who would later state in a police report that Freeman appeared depressed, paranoid, and obsessive. It seems from conversations with friends that Freeman believed that Peter would take the children back to Perth. He also believed that her parents, who lived in Perth, were in the midst of doing extensions to their home, which would support this actually happening. Freeman was also unhappy with the financial split. He was worried he wouldn't have enough money to buy a house on his own for him and the children. He was frustrated that Peter had allegedly transferred $300,000 out of their joint account around the time of their separation. There was little doubt that Freeman felt as if he was being bullied by his ex-wife. Whether these fears were rational or not, we will never know. While he was in London, contact calls with his children got muddled. Freeman felt that Peter was sabotaging his relationship with them. He was thrown by suggestions that being overseas while custody issues were in dispute could hinder his access claims. During his time in London, Freeman met a woman named Elizabeth Lamb. However, in court documents, this would be downplayed as merely a friendship. Regardless, he helped to care for her children. During a museum outing with her 3-year-old daughter, she started acting up. You know, like any normal, overtired, overstimulated 3-year-old would. But Freeman restrained her to get her to stop. When Elizabeth told him he was overreacting, Freeman started shaking uncontrollably. Freeman's father, Peter, would later testify in court that it was during this time that his son's mental health was severely deteriorating and Freeman became paranoid. At times, he appeared confused, anxious, and teary. Although at the time he returned to Australia in December of 2008, there seemed to be an improvement and no professional help was followed up. Yet a strange disconnect emerged. The more out of control he became, the more Freeman appeared to strive to keep order and routine into his life. Perhaps in response to how he was struggling with his own mental health, Freeman began becoming obsessive over his environment and daily routines. He developed systems for feeding and dishes. Freeman began becoming obsessive about collecting recipes concerning his children. Yet his apartment in Melbourne was constantly a mess of toys and clothes. Freeman had repurposed some old furniture into beds and drawers for the children in an effort to save money for them. He would also collect broken washing machines to scavenge for parts. He did this quite often as though he was trying to escape from his reality. When his parents would visit, they would try to tidy the clutter in the small apartment. A month later, in January 2009, Peter and Freeman were in court to finalise custody arrangements for their three children. During this hearing, a psychologist's report was read, taken from an interview with both parents 3 weeks prior. In the court-ordered psychologist report, Arthur Freeman was described as, quote, "tends to be irrational and contradictory. He demonstrated passive-aggressive traits and seemed to cause chaos around him," unquote. His behaviour on the day of the interview. Firstly, he turned up late. Then he disappeared and reappeared before the scheduled appointment itself, all of which distressed the children. The psychologist would report that yes, while he did hug and soothe one of the upset children, he seemed oblivious about the chaos he caused. For his part, Freeman disagreed with the report. He thought the assessment was unfair. After the custody hearing was finalised, he told his lawyers of his intentions of completing a personal development course to counter the psychologist's claims and to fight for more time with the children. The previous custody arrangement Freeman and Peter had was 3 days alternated with exchanges at Q McDonald's. With the family court hearing, this would be changed. Freeman would now have custody 1 weekend a fortnight, with a few hours on alternate Thursdays after school. By this time, this final arrangement was agreed upon. There was no obvious signs of his previous bitterness towards Peter, and she certainly saw no outward signs that her ex-husband was angry or resentful for his reduced custody. Peter would later tell police that she thought Freeman was fine with the new care arrangement. That weekend, in late January 2009, it was summer in Melbourne, and it was hot. To escape the sweltering heat, Freeman left Hawthorne late and took his three children to his parents, Peter and Norma Freeman's beach house, in Airlies Inlet overnight, leaving around 10:30 p.m. He attempted to contact Elizabeth Lamb on the drive a total of 9 times, but he'd only managed to get through to her answering machine when he arrived at Airlies Inlet. It was just on midnight. Freeman wanted to make the most of his time with his children before handing them back to their mother. It would be then another 2 weeks before he saw them again. That night, Peter called her former husband and asked to speak to the children. She was aware that Darcy would be overly excited for her first day of school the following day. Freeman bluntly told her that the children weren't with him, but he promised her that he would get them to call her the following morning before they left for the return drive back to the city. This call, though, would never be made, and Peter would not get another opportunity to hear her daughter's voice. January 29th, 2009. Arthur Freeman was up bright and early, in plenty of time to get to the kids to school, but this was not his priority. By 6 a.m, he was back on the phone, desperate to talk to Elizabeth. Again, in the 7 phone calls he attempted over the next 2 hours, he was not able to reach her. All of this did not help the routine of the morning to run smoothly. Freeman was still emotional from the custody hearing the day before, and now they were running late for school. As they were leaving the beach house for the city, Freeman's father Peter recognised his son's distressed state, and he offered to come with him for the support and to share the special day. But Freeman was adamant that he was fine and could handle it alone. The plan was to meet Peter at the school gates, and he just wanted to leave before he was too late and there would be more conflict between the two parents. Freeman had forgotten part of Darcy's uniform, as well as her shoes, which Peter had. The plan being Darcy would finish getting ready before walking into school. Freeman's mother, Norma, would later report to police that she remembered her son being short with her when he left the house, and he was obviously stressed. But despite that, she had no cause to worry about the safety of her three grandchildren. Heading back into the city for school and work, they hit the usual morning traffic, which caused them to move more slowly towards the Westgate Bridge, which would take the family into Melbourne. Now, the Westgate Bridge being the main commuter bridge taking people to and from the city. So, this meant the traffic was constantly high or at a standstill during peak hours. Darcy and her older brother Benjamin were playing games in the back seat, oblivious to the growing agitation occurring within their father. There were books and crayons to entertain them. Four-year-old Darcy had her long blonde hair pulled back into a ponytail, and she was pulling these hilarious faces and making shapes with her hands, entertaining her brothers. Six-year-old Benjamin was tapping his knees like the drummers he idolised, and two-year-old Jack was in his car seat, strapped between his older siblings and drinking from his bottle. January 29th, 2009 was meant to be Darcy's first day of school. She was only a couple of days away from her fifth birthday and she was starting kindergarten, something she'd been excited about all summer. She'd been watching her brother go off to school for the last couple of years, and she was desperate to join him on the adventures he spoke about every afternoon. Darcy would later be described by those who knew and loved her as a determined and strong-willed little girl. Darcy had a passion for music and dancing, but most of all, she adored her two brothers, and the three siblings were very close. When the car reached the Westgate Bridge at around 9 a.m, Arthur Freeman pulled his white Toyota Land Cruiser over to the left lane and stopped the car, putting on his hazard lights. Freeman asked Darcy to please climb over to the front seat. During this time, Freeman was also on the phone to his sister. He didn't indicate that anything was wrong. Instead, his only concern was he hadn't packed enough food for the children's lunches. Earlier in the drive, he also spoke to Elizabeth Lamb, his romantic love interest, who was living in London. He was worried he was going to lose custody of the children back to his ex-wife. He was crying and telling Elizabeth that he felt helpless and he wouldn't be able to cope without his children. He told Elizabeth he was going to pursue a greater custody through the courts. Her phone battery soon went dead and she didn't think about calling him back. She assumed that Freeman's crying would help him reconcile his feelings of the reality of the situation. There would be a third phone call during this drive to the Westgate Bridge. This call would be to his ex-wife, Peter, and he would call her with threats. He would allegedly tell her during this call that she needed to say goodbye to her children and that she would never see them again. This caused panic at the school. Peter would try to call Freeman back several times before he would answer, only to repeat this threat and again disconnect the call. Given the history of their relationship, Peter immediately contacted her lawyer. She was instructed to then report the children missing with the police. The school was notified of the situation, and Peter rushed home to gather up recent photos to supply to the police to accompany the missing person report. No one knows what made Freeman do what he does next. His lawyers have openly stated that they don't understand. Not the police who investigated the case, and not the forensic psychologist, who had later determined that he was not fit to enter a plea. Darcy was having difficulty unbuckling her car seat, so Freeman got out of the car and walked over to the passenger side door. He leant over Benjamin and Jack to unbuckle Darcy and lifted her out of the car. According to court documents, Freeman carried Darcy over to the edge of the bridge at the highest point. Witnesses would later report to the police that the child seemed limp and didn't struggle against what was about to happen. Due to the extensive injuries and confused and panicked witness reports, we don't know if Darcy was unconscious, or maybe she thought this was just a game, fully trusting her loving father would not do anything to hurt her. Or possibly she was in shock, having no idea what was going on. According to court documents, Freeman lifted Darcy up over his head, leant over the railing and let her go. Darcy would fall 58 metres or almost 200 feet, past the railings, past the line of cars, past the pylons, and she hit the water below at a great force. Freeman would then walk calmly back to his car and drive off, leaving a frantic scene behind him. Freeman would only stop once on his journey to his intended destination. He would stop briefly because Benjamin begged his father to go back and get Darcy because she couldn't swim, always the protective, loving big brother. Benjamin would continue his pleas long after the car restarts, and he would continue to beg his dad to turn around until they reached their final destination.
Hello, I've just witnessed a man throw a child over the Westgate Bridge.
Thrown a child, did you say?
Yes, blonde hair, in a ponytail.
At the crime scene, there would be numerous calls to police from people desperate to help, but unable to get to the child. They begged the police and emergency services to get to the scene and possibly fast to save her. Somehow, Darcy survived the fall, and witnesses reported seeing her desperately fighting to stay above the water.
A male in that vehicle has taken a young girl, we believe to be 4 years of age, and dropped her over the bridge, and she's landed in the water here at the bottom. And you think you've seen it all, but you haven't.
Water police arrived on the scene in the Yarra River within minutes. However, it would take them 15 minutes to get to her. Beyond belief, Darcy Freeman would be still alive. Paramedics pulled her from the water to take her to the nearby Children's Hospital. During the hour trip to the hospital, they worked on Darcy, trying to desperately keep her alive. One of the paramedics would later testify in court that the drawings Darcy made earlier that day on her legs would haunt her for the rest of her life. Darcy was barely alive. At one point, her pulsary started strong. Her heart started beating for a minute before stopping again. Darcy arrived at the hospital in a critical condition with brain injuries as well as extensive internal injuries. An autopsy would later show that Darcy had a ruptured spleen, a torn small intestine, a bruised heart and a collapsed lung, as well as serious brain damage caused by either lack of oxygen or from falling the 58 metres to the water. Her little body was covered in bruises and cuts. Meanwhile, the police launched a massive manhunt for Freeman. And there was some urgency now, because of the fear that he would harm the other two children based on what happened to Darcy, and the previous threats of violence. Freeman had literally told Peter she was never going to see her children again. So I can understand the urgency here, that the authorities' greatest fear was when they did find Freeman, he would be alone, and there would be a second crime scene on their hands. The search would be short, though, because at 10:30 a.m, the police received a phone call from the Commonwealth Law Courts in Melbourne City. And this building houses the Family Law Court and the Federal Magistrates Court. And both of these courts handle family law cases. This was the very court that Freeman was at the previous week for the custody hearing that would place his children back in the primary care of their mother. Security staff had been trained to recognise people in distress. They'd been responsible for the phone call to police after seeing a man in the foyer crying and shaking uncontrollably. He had two young boys with him, and he was begging security guards to take the children from him. He wasn't able to get any other words out. It would be the older of the two children who gave the security guards the names of his parents. Police arrived and arrested Freeman. Peter was contacted, and she had her parents collect Benjamin and Jack, while she hurried to the hospital to be by her daughter's side. Little Darcy Iris Freeman would die at 1:35 p.m. She was 4 years old. Once in police custody, Freeman was unable to speak. He was shaking and crying hysterically and appeared to be in deep shock. A forensic psychologist who examined him would find him unresponsive and determined that he would be unfit to interview. Regardless, he was read his rights and charged with murder. Police searched his apartment, looking for clues as to why Freeman would do such an unthinkable act. There they would find a handwritten note stuck on Freeman's television. It's not clear who wrote this note. If it was Freeman, he referred to himself in the third person. The note spoke about keeping a clear head and having a big fight on your hands. Over the coming days, the police took statements from Freeman's family, in particular his parents. They portrayed him to be a loving but unravelling father, who struggled to come to terms with his marriage breakdown and to the dramatically reduced access to the children. Norma and Peter reported to police their son was under a lot of stress on the morning of Darcy's death, but nothing to cause them concern that he might harm anyone. March 2011 would be the start of the criminal trial. Arthur Freeman would plead not guilty to murder by reason of mental impairment. Words such as a dissociative state and insane optimism were thrown around during the trial. Much weight was placed on the custody dispute that was settled on the day before Darcy's death, something that Freeman had planned to mark with friends that night. But nothing said in the courtroom would settle the many questions Darcy's mother and the rest of the family would have. The confusing dynamics for Freeman's trial were set from the first day. Freeman's defence admitted that he had committed the horror, but argued that he could not be held culpable for it. The crux of the trial itself being, was Freeman mentally impaired, or did his daughter die from his conscious, deliberate and voluntary act? We are just going to take a quick break now for a word from one of our sponsors. Popular opinion dictates that any parent that kills their child must be insane. But in the eyes of the law, such definitions are much more complex and technical. What an average person calls brain snaps or a meltdown, in the court of law, they must meet certain psychological guidelines to be legally classified as mental impairment. For Freeman's trial, references were made to the 1843 McNaughton case, which landmarked that there is a presumption of sanity, unless defence can prove otherwise. Also references to the 1990 Falcone case, where a woman's conviction for killing her husband was set aside after some psychiatric evidence was disallowed from her original case. For the defence, they argued, their client could not distinguish between right and wrong when Darcy was killed, and that he was mentally unwell at the time. However, Freeman had no psychiatric history and no criminal record before Darcy's death. Only one of six psychiatrists to interview Freeman agreed with the defence's claims. This one psychiatrist, Professor Graham Burrows, he likened Freeman's state on the day Darcy died as similar to that of a sleepwalker, that he was at the severe end of the dissociative state, so he could not have known what he was doing. For the state, consulting psychiatrist Dr. Yvonne Skinner, whose experience was in more than 80 cases of parents who killed their children, she concluded that Freeman's actions fitted what is known as spousal revenge. And this theory suggests that the child itself is not the cause of the violent rage, but instead a weapon of retribution. And if this was the case in this matter, then Darcy was simply collateral damage. Dr. Skinner likened this case to that of Robert Farquharson, whose three sons were drowned when he drove into a dam on Father's Day of 2005. And I'm hoping to cover this case in more detail at some point, if not later this year, then early next year. Yet all of this does not explain why Freeman chose Darcy to be the sole victim in all of this, instead of one or as well as the boys. Benjamin even testified as the early part of the trip being relaxed and happy. By all accounts, Darcy was Freeman's favourite, but in recent times, she'd been asking for her mother more during his time with her, and that it was her educational and social needs that was at the forefront of discussions at court for the custody hearing. However, 5 out of 6 psychiatrists that were interviewed for the trial said that Freeman was most likely anxious and stressed during the drive. He was running late for school drop-off, he hadn't packed enough food for lunches, Darcy's shoes were too big, and he had forgotten to get part of her uniform. But according to the psychiatrist, none of this would have stressed him to the point of being in a delusional state. Freeman told one doctor that all he remembered was feeling trapped on the bridge and feeling like he was a failure as a father for not getting the children to school on time, especially Darcy, as it was her first day of school. Freeman told another doctor that he did not remember phoning Peter on the drive, but if he did, that she would have berated him for being late, and that this would have added to the pressure and feelings of failure. The prosecution arguing that it was Freeman's ability to drive the car, make the phone calls, turn on the hazard lights of the car when he pulled over to the bridge. All of this showed Freeman was in a present mind, and that he was acting consciously and voluntary. As the trial came to a close, Freeman announced that he wanted to dismiss his defence lawyers and make a statement on his own behalf. This request was ultimately denied. After 19 days of evidence, the jury retired to make their decision. However, the jury was initially confused what they were to determine with their verdict. They initially thought that their role was to decide, firstly, if Freeman was mentally insane, and secondly, if he had committed the murder, but this was not the case. Regardless of his mental state at the time, Freeman had accepted he was the person responsible for Darcy's death. After 5 days, they sent a message to the judge that they were deadlocked and that there was no chance of breaking that deadlock. They were given additional time to see if they could come to an agreement. It would only take to the end of another day for them to reach a unanimous decision. Ultimately, Arthur Freeman was found guilty after a jury rejected his defence for mental impairment. Arthur Freeman was sentenced to life in prison with a minimum sentence of 32 years.
What Darcy's last thoughts might have been does not bear thinking about, and her death must have been a painful and protracted one. Any motive which existed for the killing had nothing to do with the innocent victim. It can only be concluded that you used your daughter in an attempt to hurt your former wife as profoundly as possible. You will spend what may be regarded by many as the best years of your life in prison.
Freeman will be eligible for parole in 2041. If eligible, he will be 64 years old. In his sentencing, the judge called Darcy Freeman's death a crime against human conscience. The composure that Peter Barnes maintained throughout the trial collapsed at the sentencing hearing, April 11, 2011. She broke down in tears when she attempted to read her victim impact statement to the court. In this statement, she described the personal nightmare she had lived ever since her ex-husband took her daughter from her. Only a month after beginning his sentence, Freeman started the appeal process, arguing his sentence should be reduced. This appeal was rejected. Within a year, he would file another appeal to have his sentence reduced. But once again, this appeal would be rejected.
Arthur Freeman doesn't think murdering his own daughter deserves 32 years jail. Late this afternoon, he learned some of Victoria's most senior judges disagree. In early 2009, the computer programmer horrified Melbourne when he threw daughter Darcy off the Westgate Bridge to spite his ex-wife, the four-year-old's mother. Freeman tried but failed earlier this year to have a single appeal court judge cut his sentence, today taking his case to a full bench of the Court of Appeal. His lawyer argued too much weight was placed on public outrage when his client was sentenced. Plus, he claimed the punishment was excessive when compared to fellow killer dad Robert Farquharson, who received just a year more for drowning his three young sons. The Court of Appeal disagreed. It said, like Farquharson, Freeman's crime was the worst possible kind and that, given he'd shown no remorse, 32 years jail was appropriate.
April 2012, Peter Barnes commenced a civil action suit against Vic Rhodes, and Vic Rhodes were responsible for the maintenance of the Westgate Bridge. Peter calling for safety barriers on the bridge, stating that her daughter would still be alive if Vic Rhodes had followed previous recommendations in 2005 for these barriers to be installed. And this was due to the high number of suicides from the bridge. It was Peter's determination that saw change. Initially, temporary barriers were installed, and the permanent installation was fast-tracked. Suicides on the Westgate Bridge have since fallen by 85%. The civil action suit found that Vic Rhodes did have a responsibility, and a confidential settlement was reached in 2015. July 2015, a coronial inquest was held into Darcy Freeman's death. The coroner found that no one could have predicted that Freeman was going to throw his daughter 58 metres from the Westgate Bridge that day. That the death of Darcy Freeman and the subsequent trial of Arthur Freeman was heartbreaking and complex. The inquest highlighting the many failures of our legal system and the anguish of the many friends, family and emergency service professionals who still to this day, more than 17 years later, they are still tormented over whether there was more they could have done, something they could have seen or signs they could have missed, anything that could have prevented this tragedy. But the tragic truth is that no one is to blame for little Darcy Iris Freeman's death. No one except for her father who murdered her. And no one could have predicted that Arthur Freeman was going to make that fatal decision that day. If you have your own thoughts and theories on the story we discussed today, or any stories we talk about here on Stolen Lives, please search Stolen Lives Podcast on Facebook, like the page so you don't miss an episode, and join the Stolen Lives discussion group to talk about your thoughts and theories. You can also talk to us on Instagram, Stolen Lives Podcast. If you like what you heard today, we would appreciate it if you share this episode on your social media of choice and subscribe and leave a positive review on your podcast app. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Ali. Hosting and production was also by me, Ali. Music is by Mayu.